Good evening. This is Justin Ford for From the Frontline. Tonight we are dealing with learning from the Rwandan Holocaust of 30 years ago. In the studio with me is Dr. Peter Hammond, the founder of Frontline Fellowship, who has been involved in serving persecuted Christians for over 40 years in 38 countries. Dr. Hammond, April 2024 marks the 30th anniversary of the Rwandan Holocaust. Why should listeners be interested in marking this tragic anniversary?
Well, first and foremost, if we don't learn the lessons of history, we may be doomed to repeating them. We're living in an age of tremendous intolerance, and right now it's not just in South Africa that we have political parties led by people who are talking openly about doing to the whites, coloureds and Indians of this country, the ethnic minorities, what was done to the Tutsi in Rwanda. But then we've got intolerance all over the world, which is in many ways looking at objectifying and demonizing, vilifying people that they don't like. I mean, just think of the woke group, that if you don't agree with them on some political issues, you're evil and you don't even deserve to live. And they're talking about people being oxygen thieves and good for nothing but fertilizer and all that sort of thing. So we've got in growing intolerance all over the world right now, which we need to learn that's what preceded the Rwandan Holocaust. Now, the 6th of April, 1994, was the start of one of the most dreadful campaigns of mass murder in history, unleashed upon the Tutsi tribe of Rwanda. In just 100 days, more people were slaughtered with machetes and clubs than have died from atomic weapons in all of history. I mean, think of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and then realize more people died at the hands of Chinese-made machetes in Rwanda. Very low-tech genocide. Hundreds of thousands of people killed with machetes, a bigger death toll than atomic weapons so far.
Was there any significance to the timing of this mass murder?
Well, yes. At the time, the world media attention was focused on South Africa's first one-man, one-vote, multiracial elections, what was many times called the Mandela elections. I mean, we were sort of predestined to have Mandela as the president, and this was the way everything was being pushed worldwide. They never even counted half the votes, by the way, in that election. They were taking so long, somebody worked out it would be 5 years before they finished the count. And then at one point, they just extrapolated the percentages and did horse trading. So the so-called one man, one vote, they never even counted all the votes, and they knew who was meant to win anyway, so it was just a matter of by what percentage. And so that's a bit of a farce. I did a study on the elections of April 1994 and titled it Fraud, Failure and Farce. But that election was so obsessing the world's media that all the Africa reporters and all of the war correspondents in Africa were in South Africa. So at that point, the genocide architects in Rwanda timed their genocide to coincide with the world's laser focus on South Africa, so that they thought they could get away with a lot more than they would normally be able to get away with, which actually was true. And so the MRND socialist government in Rwanda meticulously organized the genocide to coincide with South Africa's elections, hoping that the world's media gaze would be too obsessed on South Africa and Mandela to pay attention to what they were going to be doing in Rwanda.
And how were the perpetrators able to carry out such a widespread mass murder?
Well, first and foremost, they were well trained by the French. The Presidential Guard was trained by the French government, and the gendarmes, the civil administrators, they all mobilized to slaughter the Tutsi minority. So this was a government-organized operation. And central to the strategy of the MRND socialist government of Rwanda was to sow confusion. Confuse, divide and conquer. So they didn't want anyone to know what was happening, so they isolate the victims by imposing a news blackout. The first step of the genocide was cutting the telephone wires. In fact, there's one very well-made film on the genocide in Rwanda called Shooting Dogs, also released as Beyond the Gates. And the first thing this BBC reporter knew that there's something wrong was he's on the telephone, suddenly click, you know, click, click, click. Absolutely gone, the line's gone dead. They cut all the telephone lines. That was the first thing. Of course, there's before cell phones and so on. And so news blackouts, cut telephone lines, and then they established a dense network of roadblocks and imposed a nationwide curfew. So by doing a bunch of massacres quickly, people were terrified, stayed in their homes, and anyone who went out got caught at one of the roadblocks. And if you were Tutsi or married to a Tutsi or you were half Tutsi or something, that should be enough for you to be pulled out, hacked to death there by the side of the road at the roadblock. bodies piled up, people stayed in their homes, which was in fact the goal. Once they got the people restricted from travel and they isolated them, they were in their homes, and now they had the checklist of who lived where, and they had earlier done an audit of where Tutsis lived. So now they hunted down this ethnic minority, killed them in their homes, and the mobs went from house to house, door to door, room to room. So it was very clever. And they also isolated the victims by stifling the flow of news. And what sponsored it, the actual trigger, the pretext that launched the whole thing, was the assassination of the president by a surface-to-air missile, French surface-to-air missile, fired by the presidential guard itself from the presidential palace, took out the presidential plane. The only time in history that two presidents were assassinated together. President of Burundi, President of Rwanda were flying in the same plane, taken out by the Rwandese presidential guard. So it was an own goal. And this was a smokescreen designed to conceal the state-organized genocide. What they then did was a claim that the violence was spontaneous rage over the assassination of their president, although they had assassinated their own president, but still. So to confuse more people, they sent out all kinds of pleas calling for emergency relief aid. So the very government doing the massacres were calling for emergency relief aid, and they confused the mass killing of defenseless people with the war. Now, there was no war. There hadn't been war for quite a long time, but nevertheless, that was the smokescreen. And then they played this humanitarian card, please help us, we need emergency aid. And during this calculated confusion, foreign aid workers assisted in a disinformation campaign by contributing ill-informed comments like, everyone is killing everyone. It's uncontrollable violence. The Hutus and Tutsis are killing one another again. Well, it was very one-sided, so that's very ill-informed comments. The first people they killed were the opposition politicians, the Rwandese journalists, the human rights activists, and anyone else who might present an accurate report of what was going on, which was nothing but cold-blooded mass murder carried out by the government and mobilizing the population to do their dirty work. Most people were not killed by guns and bullets and grenades. They were killed by machetes. And the army and the gendarmes stood by and just basically monitored while the normal peasants and population were mobilized to actually hack to death their own neighbors, bluntly speaking. So this was all portrayed in the media as spontaneous rage in response to the assassination of the president. So it was very well orchestrated, and people around the world were so confused they didn't know what was going on for a long time.
Hmm. And what was the international reaction to these atrocities?
Not much. Initially, the international attention was focused on the plight of the foreigners. And the camera crews, very understandably, only wanted to travel with international troops. And the international troops' mission was to evacuate the foreigners. And this naturally led to a very slanted, incomplete picture being portrayed to the world. All people were hearing about was the evacuation of foreigners, and that's all they saw. And on day two, the 7th of April, 10 Belgian soldiers were massacred. And when we say massacred, I mean, that barely tells the truth. It was they were tortured to death. These 10 Belgian troops who were going to try and evacuate politicians who were obviously being targeted, they went and they were confronted by the Interahamwe mass murderers who demanded that they hand over their guns. Now, it's hard to imagine in any war or genocidal situation soldiers being stupid enough to hand their weapons over, but they did. They were ordered to hand their guns over, they did, and then they were hacked to death, like limb by limb, fingers, toes, feet, legs, arms, living people being hacked to death. And this, of course, was done deliberately. And the killers were instructed to murder these Belgians precisely to make the evacuation of foreigners the international priority. And it also further encouraged the withdrawal of UNIMIR, the United Nations Assistance Mission for Rwanda. And so the international reaction was overwhelmingly focused on, we've got to get all the foreigners out, we've got to withdraw the UN troops.
So most people know that something horrible happened in Rwanda, but there does not seem to be much knowledge of what actually happened, how it happened, and even less why it happened.
That's so true. The perpetrators' strategy of disinformation and terror was spectacularly successful. To this day, most people worldwide do not understand what happened in Rwanda or why it happened. And that's why after my mission to Rwanda, I was compelled to produce a compact book that would not only expose what happened in the horrific massacres in homes, hospitals, churches, and on the streets, but the reasons why the systematic slaughter was unleashed. And so in the book, I reveal the events that led up to this very intense, widespread violence, and more importantly, the lessons we need to learn from the genocide in Rwanda, especially as there are still people around today, like Julius Malema, talking about the fact that one day we're going to have to get rid of all the whites in South Africa and the coloureds and Indians as well. And so when there's people who are talking about we must do to the whites in South Africa what was done to the Tutsi in Rwanda, you know that this is so important that we learn from this. I was at a meeting in Kelvin Grove back several years ago, and there was an ANC member of parliament just before Mandela died. And he said, when Nelson Mandela dies, we're going to kill you whites like flies. Nice and poetic and so on. And I said to him, so like what was done to the Tutsi in Rwanda? And he said, yes, exactly, just like Rwanda. And I said, did you notice what happened? And he stopped for a moment. He didn't seem to understand what I was saying. He said, David defeated Goliath. The Tutsi minority beat the Hutu majority and now run the country. And I said, you know, the Tutsi don't have much of a military history. They don't have much of a military heritage. And yet they managed to defeat these bullies who were doing the mass murders, despite the fact that the mass murderers had the support of France and Libya. And I said, now, you know, the Boers have a tremendous military heritage, gave tremendous grief to the greatest empire in the world at the time, the British in the Anglo-Boer War, and have fought not just the First and Second World War, but through the Korean War and Malayan conflict and Angola, defeated the elite presidential guard of Fidel Castro, the Cubans in Angola. And we have 650,000 military veterans in South Africa who've actually fought a war and who've won, and they've got tremendous heritage. You never know where things are going to go when you start a war, but you start genocide. I said, there are South African mercenaries, military contractors all over the world who would come back if their own people were being slaughtered here, and they'd bring their friends as well. And you have no idea what you could unleash, but the genocidal lunatics in Rwanda might have had the majority of the population, 85%. And the Tutsi might have been a minority, 15%, much less now. But they are the ones running the country now, and nobody questions that because the Hutu have disgraced themselves and cannot be trusted with power after the genocide. So think very carefully before you take that step. You don't know what's going to happen. So anyway, there are people talking like that, and you just think of Julius Malema getting his hordes of red beret, red T-shirted EFF people, everything for Free Party, chanting the zombie dance in the stadiums. Kill, kill, shoot to kill, Baba, shoot to kill. Kill the Boer, shoot the farmer. Bring me my machine gun, all that stuff. And they have this zombie dance all jumping up and down, screaming about wanting to kill people just of their ethnicity. This is very much reminding one of what was happening in Rwanda, whipping up the Hutus to hate the Tutsi and to call the Tutsi Inyenzis, cockroaches, to dehumanize them, to vilify them, to demonize them, and to justify killing of the ethnic minority that they were jealous of. Because in Rwanda, the Tutsi were the more educated, overwhelmingly Protestant, more literacy, high standard of living. They were the cattle farmers, they were the professional people, and they traditionally had been the leaders in Rwanda. And so the socialists also whipped things up, not just with tribalism, but also class, of resenting the Tutsi and blaming them for anything that was wrong in the country. And the Hutu mass murdering government whipped this up into a fine edge. They came up with 10 commands for the Hutus, which included things like you can't be friends with a Tutsi, you cannot marry a Tutsi, and all these sort of things. You cannot work for a Tutsi. And then they sang songs about killing them and cleaning the place, cleansing the place, not just ethnic cleansing, but more than that, and feeding them to the crocodiles in the river. And they made cultural songs, and this was dominating the radio, this was dominating the newspapers, the schools, whipping the people up to hate and blame the Tutsi for anything that was wrong in the country. Well, this sort of is reminiscent of what's going on in parts of South Africa, where you can see the EFF and other radical black first land first people who are whipping up South African people to hate the whites, the coloureds and the Indians and blame them for anything that's wrong. So, yes, I think it's super important for us to know what happened and how it happened in Rwanda, because it could happen again if we're not careful. We've got to learn these lessons of history.
So you actually walked in the killing fields of Rwanda. What was it like? What did you see?
Well, no words could adequately convey the shocking impact of seeing a church building filled with corpses. No photographs could communicate the foreboding silence, the overpowering smell of death, the continuous buzzing of swarms of flies at the site of slaughter in the sanctuary. The victims of the atrocity at Ntarama, which is the first church I saw there, which is filled with corpses, they had left it basically as it was after the massacre, which occurred on the 22nd of April, 1994. There were well over 1,200 people, mostly women and children, slaughtered within the walls of the church building. An estimated 6,000 were killed in total in the surrounding Sunday school classes at the nearby school and in the bush surrounding Ntarama. There were some survivors. Some had described how the Hutu Interahamwe had thrown hand grenades into the church building, then moved into the packed congregation with machetes, chopping off limbs and heads. Some of these survivors survived by hiding under the corpses, pretending to be dead themselves and lying still. And some of them had lost a limb. And so I've spoken to some one-armed people and people with tremendous gashes from these horrible machetes. And the church at Ntarama was left untouched. I've got pictures in my book of human skulls littering the altar, the charred remains of others visible inside burned-out Sunday school classes just a few metres away from the sanctuary. During my over 40 years as a missionary to persecuted Christians, I've witnessed some pretty horrific atrocities, particularly Mozambique and Angola, but nothing could compare with the enormity of this atrocity in Rwanda. The scope and the intensity of the genocide in Rwanda is absolutely unique. Bloodstained altars, bullet-ridden doors, shattered windows, they all bear testimony to the hatred. The bloody, desecrated, looted churches, blackened by fire, shattered by blasts of hand grenades, virtually every room testified to this time of madness. In addition to Ntarama, there were congregations in Rukara, Sayahinda, and Karoma, and Shangi, Kibeho, and Gishwubu, who were all the sites of genocidal mass murder. I looked up and saw bullet holes and shrapnel holes in the corrugated iron roofs of the churches. And the other thing that was so prominent was the plague of rats. Swarms of rats, rats as big as cats, ran rampant. We went to sleep with a maglite torch in one hand and a machete in the other to ward off these ferocious rodents. The Samaritan's Purse team that I stayed with in Kigali donned Wellington boots and overalls every day to wade into the sewage system to remove the hundreds of corpses and body parts which were clogging up the entire drainage system at Kigali Central Hospital. So Kigali Central Hospital, there were at least 7,000 corpses in the hospital grounds. And so you can imagine not just thousands, millions of flying, crawling insects, biting insects, and ever-present plagues of thousands of rats complicated everything. Well, at night, we would be particularly concerned about the rats, and because the rats would be attacking us while we're lying, trying to sleep. I had rats running over my sleeping bag, over my pillow, over my face, over my body, my backpack, and had to be batting off and warding off rats all night. And there was one American volunteer lady who was particularly paranoid about rats. So she chose to sleep on a top bunk. She assumed this would provide her with the best protection, but rats don't necessarily come from the floor. In fact, the rats came from the ceiling, and next thing she woke the whole house up with her screams as rats descended on top of her from the ceiling. Every time we heard a rat trap clap shut, there would be chairs throughout the place because, you know, you could just imagine the main battle was against rats, mosquitoes, and other insects.
Oh, how could all of this be possible? Were there not many churches in Rwanda? There were reports of the East African revival in the 60s and 70s, which swept the area. Where were the Christians?
Yes, indeed. I mean, what a good question. How could these things happen? Rwanda had been described as the most Catholic country in Africa. Yet the Roman Catholic Archbishop, Monsignor Vincent Nasingumba, had also been a member of the Central Committee of the ruling MRND cabinet for 14 years, the very cabinet that planned this. The Anglican Archbishop, Augustine Mashamigu, was close to the MRND president, Habyarimana. Not only did the most prominent religious leaders in the country fail to condemn the government campaign of promoting hatred and mass murder, but they neglected to provide any real support for the victims. And the participation of many Catholic priests in genocide is documented in Holocaust Rwanda. Plainly, these church leaders failed to preach the whole counsel of God. Testimony was lifted higher than teaching. blessings were sought higher than biblical instruction. A naive support for those in power enabled the genocide. They were actually accessories. To this day, there are church leaders who were guilty of taking part in a genocide who are living today under the protection of the French government or in Canada, despite those countries having signed anti-genocide treaties. And for example, when the French government was asked, why are they helping the genocidal lunatics in Rwanda and protecting so many of these architects of genocide from justice, not extraditing them and so on? Well, the French foreign minister's response was, we are holding the line for Francophone Africa against Anglophone Africa. So, okay, they're genocidal mass murderers, but they're French-speaking genocidal mass murderers, which means we should protect them. And it's insane, but that's what's going on. You see, the poor Tutsi had been getting massacred from the day that the country got its independence in 1962. Historically, Rwanda used to be part of German East Africa. It was part of Tanganyika. So at the end of the First World War, the Versailles Treaty gave arbitrarily Rwanda and Burundi to Belgium. And we don't actually know why, but that's how the people end up there speaking French. Rwanda and Burundi, which have got Hutu and Tutsi populations, but with a Tutsi minority and a Hutu majority, these countries had been blaming the Tutsi for anything that went wrong in their country. And incredible that while they had a lot of churches and they had revivals, they filled stadiums with people for evangelistic crusades. Ronald Bonke had massive revival crusades in Kigali in the very stadium where massacres later took place. And so obviously some of the people who claimed to be Christians must have been part of the massacres as well. Of course, many of the Protestants were getting targeted. The Tutsi were mostly Protestants, so many of the Christians were the victims being targeted. But there were also other Christians who were part of the mass murderers. So most of the patients in the hospital were killed by Tutsi patients were killed by Hutu doctors and nurses, including gynecologists and obstetricians and so on. Can you imagine? And I saw the gynecology ward, the maternity section, blood splattered up the walls and onto the ceilings. And this was doctors and nurses were hacking to death their patients, mothers and babies alike, in the maternity ward. Hutu teachers were hacking to death fellow teachers who were Tutsi and students. Students were hacking to death fellow students who were Tutsi. Not only that, but policemen, doctors. On every level, you saw people in society literally killing their neighbours. In some cases, if a Hutu was married to a Tutsi, they had to kill their Tutsi husband or wife, or they would be killed themselves. And that happened on both sides, that you had them either being killed for refusing to or actually killing their so-called loved ones because that was the only way to save their lives. So absolutely hideous. It just shows you the disgraceful involvement of liberal church leaders. And it's not just the Catholics. There were Anglicans, there were Seventh-day Adventists, there were people of different denominations, Methodists and so on, involved in the genocide. And another disgraceful thing to bear in mind was the media manipulation, how the journalists lied about these things. In many cases, the journalists were involved in whipping up the hatred. And then Rwanda was a gun-free zone. The mass murderers successfully manipulated and abused the media to vilify the targeted Tutsis and to mobilize the masses of Hutus to kill their neighbors or their patients or their students, as the case may be, or their co-workers. And the scandalous role of the French government in providing assistance and training and weapons to the mass murderers, and the French military expedition that created a safe zone for the fleeing Hutu mass murderers also needs to be exposed. So it's exposed by General Romeo Dallaire, also, who's the Canadian general in charge of the United Nations military assistance mission in Rwanda. General Dallaire was pleading for aid, and he wasn't getting the food he needed, he wasn't getting the weapons he needed, he wasn't getting the ammunition. He was being ill-supplied. And then the French were flying in massive transport aircraft that were not bringing any aid at all, but they were carrying out the people who were architects of the mass murder and their families to escape justice when the tide was turning against them. And the French even sent in the paratroopers and the French Foreign Legion in Operation Turquoise, where they created a safe cordon off area where the Hutu mass murderers could flee to, where they would find sanctuary behind a line of French protection and withdraw into Zaire, what today is the Congo. And that led to the Great Lakes Wars, where these Hutu mass murderers later wiped out other tribes in Congo and led to 12 countries getting involved in an almost Africa-wide war. 12 countries involved in the Great Lakes War, millions killed in 1996 to 1997 in the Great Lakes War. And that was another flow over from the French rescuing these Interahamwe mass murderers in Operation Turquoise. They did nothing to stop the genocide, but they did stop the Tutsi taking justice out on the mass murderers who had killed him. And so the French government's aid before, during and after the genocide is also absolutely scandalous. And even to this day, France provides sanctuary to members of the MRND government who were architects of the genocide. So we also, in the Holocaust Reminder book, look at the challenges that this Holocaust presents for the Christian church. The killers did not merely kill people in churches. They killed church workers. They killed pastors, ministers, priests, nuns. But the most shocking thing is that many of the people responsible for the slaughter were actually trusted members of the congregations. On many occasions, even priests, nuns, and ministers were directly involved in the genocide. Even several heads of denominations coordinated with the Interahamwe in betraying their Tutsi congregations and co-workers into hands of mass murderers. And these Christian traitors and bloodstained bishops include top leaders in the Catholic Church and even Anglican Church in Rwanda, scandalously. And this is an indictment upon the theological seminaries and the church councils. I mean, those people who are not wholeheartedly loving the Lord Jesus and loving his word, they're not qualified to be spiritual leaders. And the Rwandan Holocaust exposes the emptiness of the superficial, self-centered, easy believism, which all too often masquerades as the gospel. Compromise and cowardice helped cause the catastrophe in Rwanda. And also shocking was the role of many doctors, nurses, teachers who directly participated in the Interahamwe mass murder of their Tutsi neighbors. Psychiatrists, obstetricians, surgeons, gynecologists, dentists, and nurses were involved in the murdering of their own patients, their fellow doctors and nurses, just because they were the wrong tribe. And many school teachers, journalists, civil servants, doctors, judges were involved in murdering their Tutsi neighbors. And so at the time I said, it seems that many of your Hutus have AIDS, an acquired integrity deficiency syndrome. But I think there's many people in the West who've also got acquired integrity deficiency syndrome. Because look at the woke crowd and how quickly they were turning on people who didn't get the vaccine or don't have the right view. And next thing, this person shouldn't be allowed to work. This person's got to be fired. This person's got to be kicked out the army or whatever. And then, you know, people kicked off planes because their baby didn't want to wear a mask and all this insanity. And remember these people saying people who don't get the vaccine shouldn't be allowed to be treated. They must just die outside the hospital. They shouldn't be allowed inside the hospital or get any medical care when they're sick. So just look at that kind of hatred that came about during the lockdown lunacy and the COVID cult masquerade madness. So you wonder, what would it take to get some people to be willing to kill their neighbors just because they've been demonized in the mass media and it's now popular to turn against them? Mm-hmm. I mean, just think of that time of madness we had during the lockdown lunacy.
Hmm. And what about the United Nations? Didn't they have a peacekeeping force stationed in Rwanda? What was the role of the UN in all of this?
Well, the United Nations official most responsible for the treacherous betrayal of the people of Rwanda, Kofi Annan, head of the Security Council at the time, after a decade of being pressured to accept responsibility, declared finally, the world failed you. Don't you like that? Not the United Nations failed you, not I failed you, the world failed you. I mean, that's a classic example of how the secular humanists avoid personal responsibility. The world failed you. I mean, that's a Kofi Annan special. I don't know if you know, but Kofi Annan's actually married to a Rothschild, and he's part of the New World Globalist Order, or he was. Right now, he's gone to his eternal reward, of course. But quite understandably, the people of Rwanda were traumatized and outraged by the treacherous treatment they received at the hands of the UN. The UN first helped disarm them. They ensured that Rwanda was a gun-free zone. And once people were disarmed, they stood by and did nothing while they were hacked to death by machetes. The UN have since been banned from Rwanda. The role of the French government in aiding and abetting the genocidal MRND government and providing sanctuary to many of the architects of the genocide led the people of Rwanda to abolish French as the national language and to establish English as the national language of Rwanda. That's how much the people of Rwanda are I mean, have you ever heard of a country just change their national language? But that's the process, because the French government was so part of helping with the genocidal lunatics that now the people of Rwanda have literally changed their language from French to English. And not only that, Rwanda's actually joined the English Commonwealth, which one of only two countries that weren't ever under the English Commonwealth or Empire, Mozambique being the other one. Now, the treachery of the UN was documented by General Romeo Dallaire, the military commander of UNAMIRA, in his book, Shake Hands with the Devil. Here's a quote from General Dallaire. "I know there's a God, because in Rwanda I shook hands with the devil. I've seen him. I've smelt him. I've touched him. I know the devil exists, therefore I know that God exists." Now, General Romeo Dallaire ended up as a drunkard on benches in parks in Canada, and just about lost his mind. And he says his greatest regret is that he didn't disobey orders, spend the rest of his life in prison, but at least with a clear conscience. He should have disobeyed his orders. And he documents how the UN undermined every attempt to save lives. So, for example, he's in charge of the United Nations peacekeeping mission in Rwanda. So he was informing the leaders in both America and the UN. So everyone from Warren Christopher, who's the American United Nations ambassador, or Madeleine Albright, or not so bright, who is the American Secretary of State, and Bill Clinton, and of course Boutros Ghali, General Secretary of the UN, and Kofi Annan, head of the Security Council, and the actual civilian responsible for UNAMIRA that he answered to was the Cameroonian Foreign Minister Boubou. That's actually his name, Boubou. Did everything they could to stop him saving lives. So everything that he requested was blocked, whether it was more food, more ammunition, anything like that. When he discovered where 1 million machetes were being stockpiled, had been imported from Red China, he was planning to go and confiscate them. And he already had the plans of planning to kill 2,000 people an hour, and all these different plans that the Tutsi had, and how they had registered exactly where every Tutsi was, and worked out block committees of Interahamwe, how to murder them in great numbers. And he had informed the Americans and the UN Secretary General all about these things. And next thing is, Kofi Annan orders them to cease and desist, and but under no means to go and confiscate those machetes. Now, why would they do that? And as he asks in his book, you know, did we give enough advance warning? Yes, we did. We knew about, as early as January, we knew about the genocide coming. And the genocide started in April. So January 1994, he was sending faxes and reports to the US State Department and to the US White House and to Secretary General, who was Boutros Ghali, to Kofi Annan, head of the Security Council, his immediate superior, Boubou. And they were continually failing to give him anything that he needed. And so could we have stopped the genocide? Yes, we could have, said General Dallaire. Could we have done more? Of course we could have done more. Should we have done more? Definitely. So this man, he says he now has to take absolute tubs of medicines every day just to be able to get up and function. He's basically post-traumatic stress syndrome, disaster area, very much plagued by the death of his soldiers, like the Belgians who handed their weapons over and got hacked to death at the beginning. The trauma of what he went through is clearly revealed in his book, Shake Hands with the Devil. By the way, the subtitle for his book is The Failure of Humanity in Rwanda. The thing about General Dallaire that's so amazing is he really believed in the UN. He's not like us who never expect anything good from the UN. He really believed the UN was going to make a difference, and that he believed in his mission. He's a true believer. So he's shattered because he suddenly found that he was working for an agency that was not part of the solution, but was part of the problem. And his testimony is all the more powerful for that purpose. Now, one of the places that I visited was the cemetery at Nyanza, which contains the graves of 3,500 people who were massacred in the ETO Technical Schoolyard, which was protected by UN peacekeepers. So it was this incident that was dramatized in the film Shooting Dogs, also released as Beyond the Gates, where the UN decided to abandon these people that had come to them for refuge. But they didn't tell them about it. They just let them assemble in a hall for a meal, And while the people were having their meal, the UN got in their vehicles and just quietly drove out the gates. And as the UN left, in came the anti-Harambee mass murderers with their machetes and axes and hacked the people to death, massacred everyone. And that's the true story on which the Shooting Dogs film is based.
So being exposed to all these atrocities must have made quite an impact on you. What were you thinking as you came away from these shocking scenes in Rwanda?
Yes, well, as I walked to the killing fields of Rwanda, sometimes knee-deep and waist-high in corpses, many thoughts rushed through my mind. Now, here I could clearly see the depravity of man, the total failure of man's attempted solutions. If the United Nations really was meant to be any kind of answer to the complex problems caused by man's rebellion to the Creator and violation of God's laws, then we are doomed. From what I saw in Rwanda, the United Nations and the humanist agenda it represents is not part of the solution, they are part of the problem. They're a core part of the problem. So bear in mind, Rwanda was a gun-free zone. Contrary to what the humanists claim, man is not intrinsically good, nor is man evolving and getting better and improving. Mankind has fallen into sin, and mankind is obviously intrinsically evil. We need strict laws, we need checks and balances, we need decentralization, we need armed citizens to restrain the evil within men's hearts. Rwanda was a gun-free zone. Armed citizens save lives, but unarmed citizens just become helpless victims. A free people need to be armed. Disarmed people can easily be exploited and oppressed. Where the government doesn't trust its citizens with weapons, the people cannot trust that government with power. I couldn't help but contrast Rwanda with Switzerland, where every family's got weapons of war in their home, and you couldn't oppress the people of Switzerland. The people are armed. They're free people. Whereas in a country like Rwanda, the people were disarmed and the UN made sure they were thoroughly disarmed and that Rwanda was a gun-free zone. In fact, they basically enabled a genocide. Every genocide of the 20th century, starting with the massacre of the Armenians in Turkey in 1915, they all began with gun control, registering guns and then confiscating guns and then ensuring that the people are helpless and at the mercy of these mass murderers. A government that fears its people should itself be feared. No government should have a monopoly of force or weaponry. And so as I was overwhelmed by the sights and smells of death all around the church, I just had to kneel down amidst the remains of the martyrs on a church steps, and I prayed the martyr's prayer of Revelation 6 verse 10 and a whole lot of other imprecatory prayers from the Psalms. How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth? So I prayed for God to judge the wicked, to comfort the relatives of the victims, and for God to have mercy on us all. Then I praised God for the reality of his resurrection, for his victory over death, because Jesus is the resurrection life, and his church is unshakable, untakable, unstoppable, unbeatable. A mighty fortress is our God. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear. Now, every night I could hear ear-piercing screams of people who were plainly terrified. By the time I returned from Rwanda, I was actually very sick. My mother, through her medical contacts, organized me to have a whole battery of tests with real specialists. And at the end, the conclusion was virus-tropical. My mother commented that virus-tropical means they don't have a clue. Well, the Rwandan Holocaust literally left me sick, body, mind, and spirit, sicker than I've probably been in the rest of my life. And I'm sure that it was not only physical. I was in a demonic area. There was, like, somebody even wrote there that all hell must be empty because all the demons seem to be in Rwanda. That's one of the comments that was actually quoted on the top of a Time magazine cover.
You produced a book, The Holocaust in Rwanda, which not only documents what happened and why it happened, but you also have a chapter on lessons learned and foundations for freedom that would prevent such atrocities happening again. Can you tell us what some of those principles are?
Yes, I think that this is, in fact, probably the most important thing for it, that while there's no doubt international moral, legal obligations to bring those responsible for the atrocities to justice and before courts of justice, and the Rwandan government has certainly tried, but of course there's others in France and Canada in particular who, despite their commitments in the so-called genocide treaty, are harboring these genocidal architects and protecting them because they're French-speaking genocidal lunatics, and that apparently is better in their mind. But I put down the key foundations we need: separation of powers, decentralization, because power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we need to have the death penalty for mass murder. We need to have restitution for property crimes. We need to have freedom of speech and freedom of movement, freedom of thought, freedom of conscience, all these foundational freedoms, and we need armed citizens, for sure. I mean, all that is critical. We need to lay foundations for the future that will prevent such nationwide oppression from ever occurring again. What we need is countries like Switzerland, decentralized, with armed citizens on the ground. That will prevent these kind of atrocities taking place. But tyrants prefer disarmed victims. Power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Armed citizens save lives. So in the Holocaust Rwanda book, I include the biblical principles which, had they been adhered to, would have prevented the Holocaust Rwanda even taking place.
Now, you've mentioned some of the films that have been made about the Holocaust. Can you just tell us which you think are the most accurate or realistic?
Well, the one that came out first was Hotel Rwanda. And unfortunately, Hotel Rwanda is filmed in South Africa and all the actors are South Africans or Americans, which is disturbing. I mean, I watch it immediately think, this isn't Rwanda. And I stayed in the Hotel Miller's Colonus, which is the so-called Hotel Rwanda. It's a multi-story building. The one they showed in the film is obviously not the real hotel. And there's no potholes in the roads and everything looks just too much like South African. Nobody looked like a Rwandese either, so I was not too impressed that way. But Hotel Rwanda was an important, carefully crafted film worth seeing. Set in Kigali during the genocide of April and May 1994, the thing about Hotel Rwanda that's good is that it's not gory or distasteful. It's made sensitively, and it focuses on the incredible true story of Paul Rusungabagina, the assistant manager of Miller's Colonus Hotel. By ingenuity and good connections, bribes and bluff, Paul managed to save the lives of 1,238 Tutsi from the genocide. And so this is quite an engrossing, gripping, ultimately uplifting film because it shows how one person can make a difference even amidst the worst conditions. And Hotel Rwanda sets the scene with ominous radio broadcasts of RTLM. Incredibly, all these outrageous, incendiary, hate-filled statements in the film are what actually was broadcast on a daily basis on national radio. Why do we hate the Tutsi? Because they are cockroaches. Rwanda is Hutuland. We are the majority. Tutsi are the minority. Hutus must kill all the Tutsis. Stay alert. Watch your neighbors. I mean, and these broadcasts are coming through. Of course, you're hearing it in English in the film. It would have been broadcast in French or Kini Rwanda, but the actual words given are accurate. And then there's this United Nations colonel who confidently announces, negotiations have replaced conflicts in Africa. And the UN officials drink toast to peace in front of a huge banner declaring peace, love, and brotherhood, UNIMIR in 1994. Meanwhile, in the background, you can hear the radio RTLM hissing, a message to our president, beware, do not trust the Tutsi rebels. Well, Paul, the hotel manager, is well connected and he easily moves from the corrupt Hutu businessman who keeps the hotel well supplied with everything for a price to the UN colonel and to a general in the Rwandan army. And in his office, the businessman urges Paul to show some interest in politics because politics are power, Hutu power. And Paul sees a container full of machetes in the warehouse. And when a mob of Hutu MRND government supporters dance past the hotel combi, they threaten the driver who they recognize to be a Tutsi. So Paul gives a clenched fist salute and utters their Hutu power slogan to escape from the volatile mob. When his neighbor's arrested and beaten by the army in the middle of the night, his wife urges him to intervene, to do something, to help him. But Paul insists there's nothing he can do. Someone who didn't like him denounced him as a rebel spy. It happens all the time. He is not family. Family's all that matters. But then fear starts to rise. And then the people are told, but the United Nations are here. The world press are here. Don't worry. Actually, there were only two foreign journalists in the whole of Rwanda at the time. And the Hutu government was planning the genocide to coincide with the one-man, one-vote elections, all-race elections in South Africa. So with all the media focused on South Africa, they knew that they could have a window of opportunity when they could kill as many Tutsi Christians as possible without the world media being able to report on it or even caring. And for some reason, this film doesn't mention the strategic timing of the genocide, though. And the statements in the film are, lots of foreign press are arriving in the country for the peace signing. That's not accurate. There were only two journalists in the country, so I don't know what they're talking about. So there's some disinformation that comes through in the film. At 6th of April, as it dawns, a state-orchestrated systematic slaughter of the Tutsi is unleashed. and part of the strategic deception operation, the Hutu government creates chaos, cuts the phone lines, cuts electricity, and releases disinformation that Tutsi rebels have killed the president, whereas actually the Rwandan government had shot down their own presidential jet with a French missile. And this is the pretext for this long-planned extermination of the Tutsi minority. And then Tutsi neighbors flee to Paul's home, and Hutu soldiers arrive to kill him. Paul pleads for their lives, offers bribes as the Hutu officers for sparing his Tutsi wife and his neighbors. On the way to the hotel, they drive past burning tires in the streets and scenes of massacres in front of suburban homes. There's Hutu roadblocks, people are herded at gunpoint. There's looting scenes, jubilant Hutus dancing in the street, crawling condemned prisoners awaiting the final blow on the ground. And at the hotel, Millis Colonus, which I've stayed in, one of the Hutu employees checked himself into the presidential suite, threatened to use his political connections if Paul tries to interfere, and says, there is the smell of cockroaches here. Why can't you smell him? I can cleanse this. And then a British Red Cross worker arrives at the hotel with Tutsi children from the St. Francis Orphanage. Paul takes them in, and that's the beginning of his rescue mission. The Canadian colonel with the UN is being interviewed by a journalist. We're here as peacekeepers, he says. We're not peacemakers. We're ordered not to intervene, which is true. They were not to intervene. But what's the point of a peacekeeper if he doesn't protect lives? Well, after the Belgian manager was evacuated, Paul faced the frustrations of trying to motivate his hotel staff to work. And when he finds them standing idly by in the kitchen, engrossed in listening to the hateful propaganda of the radio, he says, turn the radio off, get back to work. And the response of one cook is, there's no more work, the boss has left. And so the difficulty of organizing and motivating the people in this situation is quite a challenge. One of the journalists rushes in with video footage of massacres by machete, and Paul encourages them to have the film evidence broadcast. How can they not intervene when they see such footage? And there's a mob of frenzied Hutu Interahamwe militia driving up the hotel gates, taunting the UN soldiers on duty, throwing a blood-stained blue helmet at their feet. Several in the mob are wearing blood-stained UN uniforms and helmets, and they lift up pieces of flesh on the sticks. And this scene must refer to the massacre of the 10 Belgian soldiers who'd been trying to escort the Prime Minister, who was a Tutsi woman, to safety. She didn't survive. Amongst many scenes and sounds of savagery, Paul now attempts to protect the growing number of Tutsi refugees who seek sanctuary at the hotel. And he tries to maintain the dignity of a 4-star hotel, creating an oasis of safety in a wilderness of mass murder. And he hopes for a speedy international intervention to stop the slaughter and to provide safety for his hotel guests. And as jeeps laden with UN troops drive up the hotel, the refugees are ecstatic. We are saved. And then the exasperated UN colonel breaks the news to Paul. They're not going to stay. They're not going to stop the slaughter. No Rwandans, only foreign nationals are being evacuated. They check passports before the hotel guests could board the buses. And the Rwandans are devastated and stand by saying, we're being abandoned. Now, at this point, the film digresses from the truth and very offensively depicts the UN failure to intervene and stop the genocide as racially motivated. And the clearly angry, overwhelmed Canadian colonel is portrayed as saying, it's because you're black, you're African, and that the West won't intervene, the West won't intervene. That's plainly not true. Just the year before, 1993, US troops and later UN troops intervened to save black Muslims in Somalia. So the problem wasn't that the Africans, the problem was that they were Christians. The head of the UN peacekeeping operation at the time was a black man from Ghana, Kofi Annan. It's quite irresponsible, very untrue, to suggest that the Western superpowers did not care about black Africans. What would be more honest and accurate would be to say the UN wasn't going to stop the slaughter because the Tutsi were Christians, particularly Protestants, I mean, even worse than just Christians. And so all over the country, when I was doing research for the Holocaust in Rwanda, the people pointed out that the West is quick to intervene to help Muslims, but not Christians. They'll help Muslims in Bosnia, Muslims in Kuwait, Muslims in Somalia, but not Christians in Rwanda or Christians in Sudan. It's not that the UN is against Africans, they're just against Christians, which is true. The head of the peacekeeping operation there was the Cameroonian Foreign Minister Boubou, and then you've got another African from Egypt who is the General Secretary of the UN, Butrus Ghali, and you've got a Ghanaian, Kofi Annan, running the Security Council. So it was an African-run operation. You can't blame the West for racism in not caring for black Christians in Rwanda. And this is a glaring weakness in what should have been otherwise a good film. Hotel Rwanda completely lacks any spiritual dimension. They accurately depict some of what happened, but they failed to inform their viewers who was being targeted and why. It's an insult to our intelligence to suggest that 1,200 Tutsi refugees could have sought sanctuary in the middle of a genocide in this hotel without any prayer, no worship services, no hymn singing, no expression of faith or turning to God. I mean, why the Marxist and animist motivations of the Hutu perpetrators are not identified, and why the Tutsis being killed mostly in churches, schools and hospitals where they fled for sanctuary is not being highlighted. So why do Hollywood directors and scriptwriters feel they have to censor history and distort reality by cutting God and any vibrant Christian faith out of even the most desperate situations? I found a lot of Christian faith in Rwanda, but apparently it's not in Hotel Rwanda. Do they really think anyone in Africa is as secular and as godless as these pagans in Sunset Boulevard? Or are they trying to conform the world to their atheistic ideals? So the United Nations comes off quite lightly in this film, without any reference to the Tutsi refugees and their custody, whom the UN troops handed over or abandoned to the mass murderers. I went to the Kigali Stadium, the football stadium, where there had been massive revival rallies back when Reinhard Bonnke had passed through, and there were thousands of Tutsi refugees there seeking sanctuary from the UN peacekeeping force, who had a military base there. And every day, the Interahamwe mass murderers came to the gates of the UN refugee camp and gave lists of journalists, pastors, teachers that they wanted. And the UN went to trouble to find them, brought them to the gate, and they were hacked to death within sight of the UN guards at the gate. Next day, the Interahamwe came back with another list, and the UN went to trouble to find them too and bring them to the gate. And they were also hacked to death in front of the UN. And the next day, the Interahamwe came back and the UN again brought out refugees who had sought sanctuary with them, hand them over. So this is just beyond scandalous, and this is not depicted in a Hotel Rwanda film. Although Shooting Dogs does depict the UN abandoning the people they were responsible to care for. I would say that in that sense, the Shooting Dogs or Beyond the Gates film is more honest. And the Shake Hands with Devil, which is based on the UN General's life and book, is far more accurate. And I might say Shooting Dogs, Beyond the Gates and Shake Hands with Devil are all filmed in Rwanda with Rwandese actors in it. Many of the film scenes are filmed at the actual sites. But the film Hotel Rwanda is still worth watching because it does focus on the courage and ingenuity of someone to save lives in the middle of a Holocaust and offers invaluable insights, such as the scene where the Hutu army arrives to drag all the Tutsis out of the hotel. Paul asks the owner of the hotel in Belgium, who can I call to stop this? And Paul answers, the French. They're the ones arming and supplying the army. Within minutes, the Hutu general receives a radio call to leave the hotel alone. So that's an intriguing little insight. Who did you call? Asks the incredible Hutu general as he's ordering his men to stop and to withdraw. Hotel owner phoned Paul later and tells him he personally spoke to the French president. You know, this is a Belgian-owned hotel telling people to leave it alone. And the French president was able to stop the genocide on that occasion because it was a Belgian-owned hotel. The film doesn't expand on this extraordinary influence of the French government with the architects of the genocide. But I document in my Holocaust Rwanda book that the French government sent in this expeditionary force of paratroopers and foreign legion when the Tutsi resistance movement turned the tide and began to defeat the Hutu government. And while they were unable to forestall the defeat, the French military did secure the safe zone to which the Hutu could flee to escape justice at the hands of their victims. To this day, the Hutu architects of genocide are residing under government protection in France. Thank you, President Macron. So Paul is told by his business contact, soon all the Tutsi will be dead. And Paul is astounded and tells him, you don't honestly believe you can kill all the Tutsi? And the man responds confidently, and why not? We are halfway there already. And Paul sees burning homes and overturned Red Cross ambulance. He hears gunshots at night. He sees tracer in the distance over the city. He is told 500,000 Tutsi have been killed already. He urges his hotel guests, there will be no rescue. There'll be no intervention. You must phone anyone you know overseas. You must shame them to action. And then he hears on the radio US President Bill Clinton's press secretary doing verbal gymnastics over the radio. We acknowledge that acts of genocide have taken place, but this is not genocide. does not meet our criteria for genocide. And the US government kept arguing against calling this a genocide because they believed that should be reserved only for Jews and only to the Second World War. And that even though hundreds of thousands of Tutsi were being murdered, thrown into burning pits alive and so on, no, this is not a Holocaust. This is not genocide. And I've had people arguing over my title of my book, very angry that I dared to use the word Holocaust in reference to Rwanda. Well, you know, those kind of Holocaust deniers, they deny what happened to the Armenian Christians in Turkey, they deny what happened to Christians in Rwanda, or what happened to Christians in Cambodia, for that matter, or anywhere else. So the RTLM radio keeps whipping up hate against the Tutsi. The Hutus who sheltered Tutsi cockroaches are the same as the cockroaches. The graves are not yet half full. Gather up your weapons. And so these sort of things come through in the film. And I think it's good to see Hotel Rwanda because it gives a rare glimpse behind the scene of one of the most courageous and effective rescue operations in the middle of one of the worst genocides in recent history. But despite the desperate backdrop, the film is ultimately uplifting. It's inspiring and it's heartwarming because it shows that you can make a difference. One person can make a difference. Proverbs 24 says, if you falter in times of trouble, how small is your strength? Rescue those being led away to death. Hold back those staggering towards slaughter. And I would say Shake Hands with the Devil and Beyond the Gates are better films because they filmed in Rwanda with the Rwandese actors taking part. And I think they all help us understand what happened. But Hotel Rwanda's got the more uplifting story because it's focused on a man who saved lives, primarily, instead of only exposing what's bad. I hope that one day we will have similar films made on the incredible Christian courage against all odds in the killing fields of Mozambique and Angola and the Nuba Mountains of Sudan and resisting Sharia in Nigeria and the Christian courage amidst communist carnage in Zimbabwe. We know there's a market for true films in Africa. But are there film producers and directors with the courage to tell these stories accurately on the big screen? Let's pray and work for that day.
Hmm. Where can listeners learn more about the Holocaust in Rwanda, Dr. Hammond?
Well, the Holocaust in Rwanda book is available from christianlibertybooks.co.za. You can go on the website www.christianlibertybooks.co.za, email admin@christianlibertybooks.co.za. And Holocaust Rwanda is also available as an ebook through Smashwords. Again, the link is available through our christianlibertybooks.co.za. We've got some videos on the Holocaust Rwanda available on our Frontline Mission SA.org website. We've got articles on lessons learned in the Holocaust Rwanda. So if you go on to frontlinemissionsa.org, you'll find links to all of these.
Thank you very much for a fascinating yet sobering discussion, Dr. Hammond. In closing, I'd like to read from Psalm 144, verses 1 to 2. Blessed be the Lord, my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle, my loving kindness and my fortress, my high tower and my deliverer, my shield and the one in whom I take refuge. Thank you very much for joining us for From the Frontline. God bless and good night.